So welcome this evening. We take up chapter 6 in the Yoga of Divine Works, the ascent of the sacrifice to the works of love, the works of life. So before we begin, perhaps we can remember what our context is. Sri Aurobindo initiated this series before it ever became a book, in the pages of the philosophic journal Arya, beginning in 1914. By the time he had the opportunity to look over and review and revise these pages, it was 1932. During those years, he had practiced with a small group of people. It grew into a larger group of people. It collectivized itself on the 24th of November in 1926 as an ashram. And then he and his radiant collaborator, the mother, began to guide directly the sadhana of each of these people in a concerted way. Lots of questions were asked. Correspondence began, and Sri Aurobindo apparently realized that at some point he needed to reformulate what he had written in the Arya into a regular order that reflected developments and insights that had occurred after the journal ceased to be in 1921. So the wisdom of a decade he was pouring into the rewriting of this. Curiously, it did not see publication until 1948 as a book. 1946, it began to be serialized in the Advent on a quarterly basis, and a number of chapters were seen through that. And then, of course, it came out as a book, but just a couple of years before Sri Aurobindo left his body. But this was his treatment of the yoga of works in a way that represented, in a sense, the testament of his considerations. And we see new things appear, like the psychic being gets a prominence in these pages that it did not have in earlier writings. So, the first chapter was about the four aids. The shastra, the teaching, the aspirant with the enthusiasm, utsaha, the teacher, the guru, and indeed the jagat guru, the teacher of the world. And of course, time. It takes time to realize all these things. And so that first luminous chapter has so much in it that we could spend a year on that. He followed that with a chapter on self-consecration. That if we're going somewhere, where are we going? It's an internal journey. It is a matter of putting yourself as a gift on the altar of sacrifice. And then to carry that in chapter 3 into self-surrender. It has to become dynamic. It can't simply remain a psychological experience, but has to be dynamized. And as it gets dynamized, we arrive at the fourth chapter, which is the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice. So who is it? What is it that we're giving? How may we give it? In knowledge, in works, in love. And to whom do we give it? But to the Supreme, who is everywhere, who is in all of these beings, but who can receive directly our offering in an integral way from an integral seeker. And of course, last chapter that we read was the ascent of the sacrifice. So if we ignite this aspiration in us, and if we recognize that ourselves and all of our experiences are to be poured into this flame of offering, where does it go? It goes first in knowledge of works. the works of knowledge, and then followed by the works of the emerging soul. This is what he's treated so far, and now we come to this, the works of love, building upon this emergence of the soul power in us, and then we'll arrive at the dynamization of life. So this is quickly where we're going, but you can see this is like a series of Vedic steps that he's aligning here. He's kept that scheme, even though he's brought it up to par for 1932 and the yoga that the Sri Aurobindo ashram is generally and collectively pursuing. And it opens this chapter with this sentence. It is therefore through the sacrifice of love, works, and knowledge, with the psychic being as the leader and priest of the sacrifice, that life itself can be transformed into its own true spiritual figure. The leader and priest of the sacrifice. The first words in the first hymn of the first mandala of the Rig Veda are Agnim ile Purohitam. Agni is the priest who leads the sacrifice. And Agni is the mystic fire, but not something that simply sits on the altar with a flame burning like this, but is dynamic. It is the leader of the march as well, as we discussed last time. And Agni, in the pantheon of the gods, of the Vedic gods, represents the psychic element in us. But as all things conscious, as all things aflame with divinity, Agni's home is not simply in our hearts, it is a universal fire, Vaishvanara Agni. It is a transcendent fire from the world of the sun, Surya, supramental in origin, universal in manifestation, but stationed in the heart of all of us, this Agni, who is unquenchable, who forever moves forward, who offers every experience that it touches and all the insights that it can gather from its life, again and again and again, continuously. So that is the leader of this triple sacrifice, love, works, and knowledge. It's the soul in us. Divinely origined, doesn't happen by an accident of molecules colliding. This pre-exists the universe. You are more ancient than the universe. If the sacrifice of knowledge, rightly done, is easily the largest and purest offering we can bring to the highest, the sacrifice of love is not less demanded of us for our spiritual perfection. It is even more intense and rich in its singleness, and can be made not less vast and pure. This pure wideness is brought into the intensity of the sacrifice of love when into all our activities there is poured the spirit and power of a divine infinite joy, and the whole atmosphere of our life is suffused with an engrossing adoration of the One who is the All and the Highest. So this is a triple and synthetic path that sounds very like the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita carried to its logical conclusion. For then does the sacrifice of love attain its utter perfection when offered to the divine all. It becomes integral, catholic, and boundless. And when uplifted to the supreme, it ceases to be the weak, superficial, and transient movement men call love, and becomes a pure and grand and deep uniting Ananda. And this, again, Bhagavad Gita, the 18th chapter, shlokas 54 through 57 is the beginning, and it rolls on from there. Although it is a divine love for the supreme and universal divine that must be the rule of our spiritual existence, this does not exclude altogether all forms of individual love or the ties that draw soul to soul in manifested existence. A psychic change is demanded, a divestiture of the masks of the ignorance, a purification of the egoistic mental, vital, and physical movements that prolong the old inferior consciousness. Each movement of love, spiritualized, must depend no longer on mental preference, vital passion, or physical craving, but on the recognition of soul by soul, love restored to its fundamental spiritual and psychic essence, with the mind, the vital, the physical, as manifesting instruments and elements of that greater oneness. So he's saying, discover, purify, and then act on a soul basis. He does not say, when he says each movement must be spiritualized, he doesn't mean it has to be ethically lifted up into a moral purity. That's not what he's talking about. When Sri Aurobindo uses the term spiritual, he means the recognition of the one reality everywhere. So soul seeing soul. He is not asking for the abolition of human love. He wants it placed inside this larger spiritual awareness. It is not the annihilation of human affection. It's making it grander, more magnificent, by placing it in the overarching reality that unites us all. Huh? No separation. No renunciation. In this change, the individual love also is converted by a natural heightening into a divine love for the divine inhabitant immanent in a mind and soul and body occupied by the one in all creatures. All love indeed, that is adoration, has a spiritual force behind it. And even when it is offered ignorantly and to a limited object, something of that splendor appears through the poverty of the rite and the smallness of its issues. For love that is worship is at once an aspiration and a preparation. It can bring, even within its small limits in the ignorance, a glimpse of a still more or less blind and partial but surprising realization. For there are moments when it is not we, but the one who loves and is loved in us, and even a human passion can be uplifted and glorified by a slight glimpse of this infinite love and lover. So we are not to do this weak and withdrawn, rather given to action. The action is a gift. It is the act of adoration. It is for this reason that the worship of the god, the worship of the idol, the human magnet or ideal are not to be despised. for these are steps through which the human race moves towards that blissful passion and ecstasy of the infinite, which, even in limiting it, they yet represent for our imperfect vision when we have still to use the inferior steps of nature has hewn for our feet and admit the stages of our progress. Did I skip a sentence? Did I skip a line? Okay. Certain idolatries are indispensable for the development of our emotional being. Nor will the man who knows be hasty at any time to shatter the image unless he can replace it in the heart of the worshiper by the reality it figures. This is something the Gita suggests in the 17th chapter, and that the mother stated very directly. You have no right to take a person's faith away unless you have the power to offer something better in its place, something more powerful. So listen with respect. And when you are divinely urged from within, if you have the capacity to convey that greater vision, then do. But wait for that prompt. Moreover, they have this power because there is always something in them that is greater than their forms, and even when we reach the supreme worship, that abides and becomes a prolongation of it or a part of its Catholic wholeness. Our knowledge is still imperfect in us, love incomplete. If even when we know that which surpasses all forms and manifestations, we cannot still accept the divine in creature and object, in man, in the kind, in the animal, in the tree, in the flower, in the work of our hands, in the nature force, which is then no longer to us the blind action of a material machinery, but a face and power of the universal Shakti. For in these things, too, is the presence of the eternal. This is not the only time in these paragraphs we'll read tonight when we'll hear echoes of Sri Aurobindo's awakening to the universal, to the universal divine, which occurred to him when he was in the Alipur jail. An ultimate, inexpressible adoration offered by us to the transcendent, to the highest, to the ineffable, is yet no complete worship if it is not offered to him wherever he manifests or wherever even he hides his Godhead. In man and object and every creature. So the highest, param bhavam, in man, manushim tanum ashritam. These are both taken from the Bhagavad Gita. It's the 9th chapter, shloka 11. And ignorance is there, no doubt, which imprisons the heart, distorts its feelings, obscures the significance of its offering. All partial worship, all religion which erects a mental or a physical idol, is tempted to veil and protect a truth in it by a certain cloak of ignorance, and easily loses the truth in its image. But the pride of exclusive knowledge is also a limitation and a barrier. So we must see that farthest view is still emanated by this supreme transcendence who establishes itself as the universe. It is only that being in the very heart, in the very tissues of humanity and beyond humanity, which is yet real. And this urge to then protect from disclosure this high secret has to be put down. because it is to be released, revealed, and rejoiced in. I won't take the time now, but there's a great story about Ramanuja when he was given the supreme mantra by his guru, raced out and shared it with everyone, horrified his guru. And his teacher confronted him and said, "Why did you do this?" "Because you told me it would liberate everyone if they heard it. So I had to run to the roof. I had to run to the roof and shout it out. And the people from the fields came, and the people in the town came. Because why would I not want to give this?" And his teacher looked at him and said, "I am the student. You are the teacher." And he bowed before him and made pranam. And it was the recognition of soul by soul. It shattered the ego of the teacher. This urge that we have, "No, you're not prepared. You're not worthy yet. You must do more work. And then one day, a fine moment will come when I will impart this great truth to you." Oh, nonsense. Stop. Give it. Give it. And ignorance, oh, I read that. I'm ignorant. For there is concealed behind individual love, obscured by its ignorant human figure, a mystery which the mind cannot seize, the mystery of the body of the divine, the secret of a mystic form of the infinite, which we can approach only through the ecstasy of the heart and the passion of the pure and sublimated sense, and its attraction, which is the call of the divine flute player, the mastering compulsion of the all-beautiful, can only be seized and seize us through an occult love and yearning, which in the end makes one the form and the formless, and identifies spirit and matter. It is that which the spirit in love is seeking here in the darkness of the ignorance, and it is that which it finds when individual human love is changed into the love of the immanent divine incarnate in the material universe. So yes, we begin inside in this ecstatic union. We hear that flute. We answer that call. We rise in our consciousness and have sublimated our subliminal beam, the subtle physical, the inner emotional, the inner mental, all rise to meet that, all pushed forward by the emerging psychic power from within. And we rise into that experience. Oneness with that must extend itself and unify. And unify spirit and matter. We are that point, that nexus, where the transcendent meets the universe. As with individual, so with universal love, all that widening of the self through sympathy, goodwill, universal benevolence and beneficence, love of mankind, love of creatures, the attraction of all the myriad forms and presences that surround us, by which the mentally and emotionally man, by which mentally and emotionally man escapes from the first limits of his ego, has to be taken up into a unifying divine love for the universal divine. Adoration, fulfilled in love, love in Ananda, the surpassing love, the self-wrapped ecstasy of transcendent delight in the transcendent, which awaits us at the end of the path of devotion, has for its wider result a universal love for all beings, the Ananda of all that is. We perceive behind every veil the divine, spiritually embrace in all forms the all beautiful. A universal delight in his endless manifestation flows through us, taking in its surge every form and movement, but not bound or stationary in any, and always reaching out to a greater and more perfect expression. This universal love is liberative and dynamic for transformation. For the discord of forms and appearances ceases to affect the heart that has felt the one truth behind them all and understood their perfect significance. The impartial equality of soul of the selfless worker and knower is transformed by the magic touch of divine love into an all-embracing ecstasy and million-bodied beatitude. All things become bodies, and all movements the playings of the divine beloved in his infinite house of pleasure. Even pain is changed, and in their reaction, and even in their essence, things painful alter. The forms of pain fall away. There are created in their place the forms of ananda. And you'll remember Sri Aurobindo's candid expression of how he experienced the divine while incarcerated in solitary confinement in the Alipur jail, that he discovered the universal to be the face, the being, the body of Vasudeva, a form of Krishna, that in every experience he found intense ananda, even when he was surrounded by ants and they attacked him ferociously. He felt each sting to be a fierce form of ananda. And if he widened his being, it became a play of delight. And instead of feeling himself educated at Cambridge to be superior to the people incarcerated with him, who were common laborers put away for petty crimes, sharing cells with him sometimes, he found them to be exemplary, to be filled with heroism, to have expressive in their beings what he could palpably feel as a divine power throbbing in them, leading them forward in their own way. So this is not simply poetry. This is not simply an afflatus coming from above that wants to get stationed in wonderful words. It's the transcript of a living experience. This is, in its essence, the nature of the change of consciousness which turns existence itself into a glorified field of a divine love and ananda. Existence, consciousness, bliss, satchit ananda, yet again. Because always we come back to that, don't we? Wherever the story begins, wherever it ends, it is wrapped in the reality of that conscious existence whose nature is delight, and nothing escapes it. In its essence, it begins for the seeker when he passes from the ordinary to the spiritual level and looks with a new heart of luminous vision and feeling on the world and self and others. It reaches its height when the spiritual becomes also the supramental level, and then also it is possible not only to feel it in essence, but realize it dynamically as a power for the transformation of the whole inner life and the whole outer existence. So the truth power of the supermind as the agency of Satchit Ananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss, unified in essence, never divided, is the key to solving the cosmic question. So, I think it's a great place, since he's put a mark there, for us to place our mark, and we'll continue from that point next week. Here's a section, we may as well read it tonight. From Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 5, The Finding of the Soul. And this begins on page 526. A being stood, immortal in transience, deathless, dallying with momentary things, in whose wide eyes of tranquil happiness, which pity and sorrow could not abrogate, infinity turned its gaze on finite shapes. Observer of the silent steps of the hours, eternity upheld the minute's acts and the passing scenes of the everlasting's play. In the mystery of its selecting will, in the divine comedy, a participant, the spirit's conscious representative, God's delegate in our humanity, comrade of the universe, the transcendence ray, she had come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance. A joy in the world, her master movement here, the passion of the game lighted her eyes. A smile on her lips welcomed earth's bliss and grief. A laugh was her return to pleasure and pain. All things she saw as a masquerade of truth, disguised in the costumes of ignorance, crossing the years to immortality. All she could front with the strong spirit's peace. But since she knows the toil of mind and life, as a mother feels and shares her children's lives, she puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man, into a hidden region of the heart, to face the pang and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure earth's wounds and labor mid the labor of the stars. This in us laughs and weeps, suffers the stroke, exults in victory, struggles for the crown. Identified with the mind and body and life, it takes on itself their anguish and defeat, bleeds with fate's whips and hangs upon the cross, yet is the unwounded and immortal self supporting the actor in the human scene. Through this she sends us her glory and her powers, pushes to wisdom's heights through misery's gulfs. She gives us strength to do our daily task, and sympathy that partakes of others' grief, and the little strength we have to help our race. We who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape, and on our shoulders carry the struggling world. This is in us the Godhead small and marred. In this human portion of divinity, she seats the greatness of the soul in time, to uplift from light to light, from power to power, till on a heavenly peak it stands a king. In body weak, in its heart, an invincible might, it climbs, stumbling, held up by an unseen hand, a toiling spirit in a mortal shape. Here, in this chamber of flame and light, they met. They looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul. Then, with a magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and grew one. Namaste, namaste. I salute that being in you. Much love to all our friends on Zoom. Thank you. Thank you for coming.